Hello, and thank you for lending your ears to RateHub.ca's Real Money Talk podcast. In this show, we give you the real talk on all things money. We eliminate the fine print, we junk the jargon, and we explain how you can make smarter financial decisions. We're not millionaires, we're thousandaires, and we know you are too, so this show is for you. We want to talk about money because it affects everyone, rich and poor. Money shouldn't only be the occupation of the 1%, but rather the 99%. Avocado toast ain't the reason you're broke. Don't hold out lattes for paydays. Let's make money in everyday discussion. Thank you for tuning in to RateHub.ca's Real Money Talk. My name is Tyler, Senior Content Strategist at RateHub. Today on the show, we go in a bit of a different direction. We're known for great guests to discuss the best ways to earn more, spend less, and invest the rest. Now, of course, if you follow all that smart financial information and advice that's out there, you'll have enough money. You'll be set for life, you know, a nice house and a good car. You'll travel often, all that stuff that we all strive for. But does the journey stop there? Life is a journey, and, you know, the path to happiness is filled with ups and downs. The low points help us realize those high points that we go through. So when is it enough? You know, frequently we ask on this show, what's your number? And well, what is your number to retire, walk away from it all, and live the life however you want? And once you have that number, and seriously ask yourself this, what comes next? And the reason I want to bring that question up is because our guest today bootstrapped his own digital marketing agency, Seer Interactive, 19 years ago. And a little while back, turned down a $50 million offer to buy his company. He had his number to walk away. He had the opportunity at life-changing money. He wrote a blog, and one of the paragraphs says, and this is a direct quote, "My house is enough. My cars are enough. My kids' private school is enough. My vacation fund is enough. I've seen enough of the world. My rainy day fund is enough. My take my parents on vacation fund is enough." I love that one. "My buy a small house for my in-laws to move near the grandkids fund is enough. There is no more life-changing money for me. I lived a life well within my means. So what do I do when I'm content?" And we're going to get into exactly that. Welcome, Will Reynolds.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being on the show. It means a lot to me that you're here. On this show, we always kick things off with a money mistake or makeup. I'll go first. I started running a few months ago, and yeah, I saw that you are also a runner. And so you probably are familiar that you can run into some problems. I had like an IT band and a knee issue. I went to a physiotherapist. She was awesome. Told me how to correct my run. I was running, you know, two wide strides and told me to run in little strides and pick up my cadence. And I was doing stretches before and after. And I finally, I went for a long run. Well, a long, not that long in your world, I'm sure. The next day I was practically limping and someone said, "Well, how old are your shoes?" And I was like, I don't know. I don't even remember buying these shoes. And, so I bought a new pair of shoes. And everything is now fine. And so my mistake is actually not spending the new money on new shoes and cost me pain and injury. So health, I guess, is another form of wealth. Anyway, Will, how about yourself? Money mistake or makeup?
I think that the biggest money mistake that I made, I'm glad I made it early in my life. I was one of those folks that just like ran my credit cards up in college. And, you know, before we had cell phones, it was like one of those things where like I'd be at the supermarket, like, you know, swiping my credit card and it's like decline. And you're like, "Well, let me put back the hot dogs." Swipe again. Decline. "Let me put back the bread," you know, and eventually like swipe. Yay. There's enough to go through because you couldn't check your balance. Like, you know, it's something we take for granted. So then you get the embarrassment of being places and being like, I could have sworn it worked. It's like, no, like I spent a bunch of money on a lot of dumb stuff when I was young. Spring breaks, Abercrombie shorts, and Doc Martens, and stuff that like put me in such a bad place financially early on that I'm actually thankful for that pain at a young point because then it affected the rest of my life. Like I got out of debt when I was probably 25, 26, and I've never been in debt since. I'm glad I learned that lesson early because now I realize like what it's like to be out of debt.
That's a great point, and it bleeds perfectly into our very first question for you. We talk a lot about generational wealth, and it's unfair that some people are born higher up on the ladder than others. And personally, as a white male, I recognize my privilege, especially growing up in a middle to upper middle class family. I didn't really have a lot of the barriers. I mean, I still graduated with debt. You wrote that coming from nothing is a superpower. And so I wanted to ask, how did your, like, in that debt story is kind of perfect, because how do you think your childhood upbringing affects who you are today?
It's interesting. It's very interesting. I think when you get to a point of enough, one of the things that I struggle with is that my kids won't see me struggle financially. And I think that me watching my parents struggle financially as a kid, I was like, oh, like, I remember my mom would sit there on Sundays, every Sunday, she would be like balancing the checkbook and looking at where the debits and credits were coming from. And I didn't know what was going on, but I recognized that it was an important thing to make our family run. And I had respect for that, you know, yeah. And now my kids, they're never going to see anything like that. And I think it's really hard. It's hard to look at yourself and your quote unquote success and say, I don't think that I can recreate that in my kids, because what created it in me was seeing some amount of, we were always that family that my parents could afford to send me to private school, but I was always the kid at private school who was from the town that didn't really have the same dollars as the other kids. So I had something to look up to in the sense of like, ooh, those people that have two doors on the front of their house, that's some rich people shit. And like, my kids won't have that, because unfortunately we're at a level where we're those people with the two door front door. And it's like, damn it. You know, I think that's the hardest thing that's been on my mind the most is how am I going to try to raise my kids to be closer to how I was raised? Because I think if they turned out with the responsibilities that I have to community and all these other things, that they'll be good humans.
Yeah. That's, you know, I try and preach to my kids gratitude as well, and just to try to understand, but you know, my kids are 5 and 7, they can't get it. They, you know, they just want the next toy. And
let me give you an example of how deeply embedded this stuff is in your kids and how early it happens. And this, it helped me to realize, like, I can't do anything about it. Like, I can try to be cognizant, but like, there's certain things that are just going to funnel in that you're never going to be able to think could be possible. So I was in an airport lounge in Vancouver on my way back from a conference, and I'm with my son at the time, I only had one, and my wife and our nanny, and my two-year-old is pointing at this woman who's in the lounge, who's cleaning up the dishes and whatnot. And he starts saying, Anna, Anna, Anna. I'm like, why is my kid pointing at this woman who's cleaning up? It's an Asian woman cleaning up in this airport lounge and calling her Anna. And it was like, oh my God, we have a person that takes care of our house, and her name is Anna. And my son has connected that people who clean up after us are named Anna. He did that at 2.5 years old in an airport lounge. And you're like, how do you untrain that?
How do you, like, you can't, yeah.
You can't. There's just certain things that your kids will be exposed to that, that if you tried not to expose them to, then you would be like, why am I not in the airport lounge? Like, I want to be in the airport lounge. What am I going to not be in the airport lounge? I can teach my kid a lesson. And then I'm like, out there with everybody else, you know? I think it's just tough, you know, and it's one of the things that I just think is, it is what it is, but it's tough.
When you talked about how you lived in a different neighborhood and then went to the, it's an argument for those mixed residential homes, mixed residential areas. So, because those living in those two-door homes need to see the others and say, hey, we could help them. And those, the people that are, you know, living in subsidized housing or government housing, they need something to look up towards. So I think, you know, you provided that excellent example for that. So thank
you. This is why I live in the city. I can never move out of the city. Because my kids see homelessness every day. My kids see people fucked up on heroin every day. Like, they see things, right?
Right.
And we get to have conversations. Whereas if everybody's dad runs a business and we all live on the same cul-de-sac, then what they think struggle is, you know, a small second home down the beach, instead of like, oh, struggle is this person is homeless, and how can we be a part of that? How can we pay respect? Like, you know, so my son, you know, there was a bunch of homeless folks living near our house. And he was like, we should let them move into our house. And it's like, great, I get to have that conversation with you.
Yeah.
By living in the city, I get to have that conversation with you about, yes, we have a responsibility. That may not be the way. But like, what if we put like up like a whiteboard and we said, like, do you need anything? And that they can write back to say they need something, and then we can make sure things get dropped off for them. Right.
Right.
And you get to have different conversations when you live in the city, and especially in a neighborhood like I live in, which is gentrifying. So there's a little bit of that, like, old and new still. So.
Yeah. And you're in Philly, yeah?
Yep, I'm in Philly.
Yeah, nice. So another quote that you had, talking about the nanny and the Anna pointing story, you said, I live in fear of getting used to more and more shit that separates me from most people's reality. And you should too. That is how you start going from, if I could only have a million, to, nah, I need a billion. So in your growth from like entrepreneur to, well, I mean, you're still an entrepreneur, you're still a founder, and then now you have, you know, 100 and some odd employees working for you. How do you avoid the trap of never enough?
You intentionally don't hang out with other entrepreneurs. I find it's a trap. I once was at a conference in Munich with Rand Fishkin,
We
talked about Moz and MozCon, and Richard Baxter and Will Critchlow. And they're all speakers at this conference. And we go out for dinner at this place. And, you know, I was like, holy smokes, man. Like, I just got to speak at a conference in Munich. Like, that's crazy. Like, that's amazing.
Cool.
Like, yeah. That's such a cool thing, right? And this was early in my career. And we all go out to dinner. And then Rand had just raised a bunch of money for Moz. And I think it was like, you know, he raised like $15 million or something. And like, you know, Richard Baxter's company at the time was like growing like crazy, so much faster than ours was. And Will had something that he was working on that was just doing really well. And I remember going into that dinner, feeling great about myself, and then leaving that dinner, comparing myself to other people and not feeling as good as I did on the way in. And I was like, this is why I will not hang out with entrepreneurs, because so often, you know, or either I can't hang out with them, or I have to learn to manage that part of myself.
Yeah.
Because we're competitors. I love competition. I love us trying to win against each other, right? So I like that. But that was the real eye-opening moment for me, that I was like, oh, you hang out with people that are raising all this money and doing all these things, you have to learn either extract yourself from the situation, or learn to be like, but that's not what I want. Like, you know, like, it's good for them, but like, that's not really what I want, nor should I compare. You know, there's a quote, comparison is the thief of joy. And it's like, that's exactly what it is. Right. You can go in and be so happy about something, compare yourself to somebody else. And then that's how you end up in a bad money place, because for all you know, like, the person that's got the things that you're trying to get has got like, you know, 50 million bucks in the bank. Right. And you're getting that same shit on credit cards. And there's a difference in how that ultimately plays out.
You know, in different money books, they talk about, you know, having like the budget car, the Toyota Corolla kind of thing. And then, so when you show up at work, or when you interact with new friends or new people, they sort of look at you and you're driving a Toyota Corolla, but secretly behind closed doors, you know, you also drive home and park in your driveway and or covered garage and, you know, connected to your home and walk out to your pool kind of thing. So
I know an executive, it's funny you bring up Corolla. There's an executive that I know who makes $750,000 a year and drives a Toyota Corolla. And, you know, we judge, right? You pull up next to somebody in a Range Rover and you assume that they're more successful. And I'm like, this dude's clearing almost a milli a year in salary. Like, and he's pushing a Corolla, right? And I think that that's actually what you find, is that the real rich people are the ones that don't typically have those things.
I'm pretty sure there's a thing with like Warren Buffett and Jeff Bezos and like, all these guys were driving like sort of clunkers, even when they were starting to really pull in the big dollars. Cause I mean, there's a thing, there's a values thing as well there. Like, do you value a car? So when you were first approached to about your business, you know, and asked about that number, you had to come up with a number though.
Yes.
Right. And you wrote that it was a major struggle to come up with whatever that number was for you. And, you know, to the people listening, I mean, I haven't even figured out that number myself, but it must, I look at it kind of like it's a mountain to climb. Now you climbed that mountain. So I want to ask, you know, what was that process like? And was it a great feeling when you sort of came to that realization?
No, it wasn't like a great feeling, because it was like, it was more like, oh, that's how I've already been living my life. Right. Hmm. It was very like, oh, I've been living well below my means for ages. I just now haven't, I've been doing that so long that now I can choose to retire if I want, or not work another day in my life if I want, or, you know, I don't have to sell my business in order to get to that number. Right. So no, it wasn't like a relief. But it was helpful to have something to give to my like wealth team to bounce against and have them kind of be like, can you really live the rest of your life? Or like, you're young, you know, they're like, you're young. Like, can you really live the rest of your life on that? And it's like, okay, well, I can look at this history of how I've made decisions for the last 15, 16, 17 years. And I'm like, I can be really content without a lot. Having money is almost like the sprinkles on top of the ice cream, right? But for me, it's like, I got the ice cream, you know? So it's like, it's like, yeah, I can buy a nicer car, or yeah, I can buy a nicer sofa. But it's like the end of the day. So I'm actually building a house right now. And, you know, we're working with our interior designers, and they had some like bookshelf for my kids that was like $1,000 bookshelf. I'm like, no, like, I don't have $1,000 piece of furniture in my current house. Like, there's no way. Right. So like, for me, I have a deep, it's interesting. And I had to remind them, I'm like, guys, this makes me uncomfortable because I know what I can do with that money in the world. And it's hard for me to make that something that my kids are just going to throw their books on, when I could have gotten something at IKEA for $50, like, to do the same purpose. You know, it's like, so I have a discomfort going through this process of furnishing the house has shown me, like, just a values thing, where I've been like, ooh, I'm really uncomfortable knowing that this thing costs this much. And I think that I can't have something like that in my house that costs X that I don't see value in, that I feel like IKEA does just as good of a job in, even if I have the dollars to get this extravagant fucking thing, you know?
I can't, it's such a, our sub line on the podcast is a fresh take on personal finance. And I think that this is such a fresh take. I appreciate everything you're saying, because I think it's so valuable to realize that when you get there, I mean, if you like to wear Crocs as shoes every day, you can still buy Crocs. You don't have to buy, you know, Gucci's version of Crocs.
The minute, you buy Gucci, I think you have to look at yourself and say, why am I buying Gucci? Like, am I really like a connoisseur of like great fashion, or am I just buying a label so people know, you know, that I've made it to a certain level? And I think that we all need to do that internal work to understand our why. Because like, my designers were like, oh, well, this thing is custom, and like, everything's custom. I'm like, why am I getting a custom made sofa when I can go to Pottery Barn? Like, why would I get a custom sofa? I'm like, does it somehow feel better? Do they like mold it to my butt cheeks? To where it's like, oh, okay, I'll pay that kind of money for a sofa molded to my butt cheeks.
Massage on.
Right? I'm like, oh, I like the lower part of my back to be massaged. If I can program that in, I'll pay for it. But if it's just another sectional, why am I getting it custom built, right? Like, for what? So I can say, tell people it's custom. Like, what's the purpose? So yeah, you know, I have a lot of struggles. I do. And it's interesting, right? I think.
But they're good struggles. Yeah, they're good struggles. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. The reason that we talk about money, the reason that the show exists, is to try and make money an accessible topic. And I think that, you know, collectively as humans, we fail to talk about money often, like, especially things like salary or how much we have saved. You know, how much you invested? Oh, you know, it's we're comfortable. It's a double-edged sword, because you don't want to seem like you're too rich and you should be buying all the drinks when you go out for friends or something like that. But you also don't want to miss out on events because, you know, your friends aren't things that think that you can't afford to go out with them.
Who needs those friends?
And you said that, and I believe it too, that debt is the mother of all stress. you've eliminated the stress. But when you were talking earlier in the show about, you know, buying the Birkenstocks and stuff like that, what would you tell your younger self now about money?
How much younger?
Like the guy that's swiping the credit card and it's just getting declined.
Oh, I would tell him he's an idiot. Yeah.
What advice would you give? Would you give to him?
The advice that I would give is to say, if you don't stop this, you will spend your whole life buying stuff to impress other people, and you won't be happy, because that lifestyle comes along with, like, everybody sees your car and congratulates you when you buy it, but they're not there when you got to freaking rub your temples together to figure out how you're going to pay it every month. And that's the reality for so many people, is you like that dopamine hit when everybody's congratulating you, but then nobody actually sees that you're going home stressing, sweating it, trying to figure out, you know, man, well, if I don't, like, oh, so then you have to take this job you don't really want because it pays you enough for you to live the lifestyle, for people to tell you you're successful. But in actuality, you hate your fucking job, but you can't leave it because the job you really want pays you 30% less. But how are you going to afford the Range Rover? And ooh, once I get rid of the Range Rover, nobody like congratulates me on the Honda Accord. And you got to be really in touch with yourself. Money and financial independence requires a lot of self-reflection, because it's so easy to slip into doing things for other people and not knowing why you're doing them.
That's a quotable. Yes. You said leveling up your lifestyle is a major factor in keeping you from your enough.
Yeah. You just keep telling yourself, like, the one thing about leveling up your lifestyle is the negative. The only negative I've seen so far in me living today, like I did. So one of the things I always tell people is, when Sear did $1 million in sales, that year I ended up buying a house and a car. And I still live in that house today. And Sear did $35 million last year, right? So you have to think 35X on revenue. I'm living in the same house, and I just recently traded the car in, like, 4 months ago. And it's like, if you had to come to my house.
You traded it
in. Of course I traded it in.
That's great.
But I say that to say, like, that's what it actually sounds like when you don't level up your fucking lifestyle. So when I say it, it's easier when I give you the numbers, right? Sear does $1 million. Yeah. I move into this house. I buy this car. Sear does $35 million. I'm in the same house and have the same car. That's what it actually looks like when you're not leveling up your lifestyle. It's not, well, I'm at this level and the company's been solid now for 5 or 6 years. I should get
I deserve it. Yeah.
You know, if you want to be financially independent, don't hang out with anybody that ever says to you, you deserve X. You deserve to take a vacation, because they're not. Are you paying for my fucking vacation? Then don't tell me what I deserve. Because people will tell you, oh, you deserve to treat yourself. You deserve this. You deserve that. And it's like, those people are dangerous because they never pay your bills. You're the one stuck rubbing your temples. Like, oh my God, how am I going to, like, how did I get into all this debt? It's because you keep listening to people be like, you deserve to treat yourself. Are you paying for me to treat myself? And you can shut the F up.
So we're not yet in post-COVID. We're in, Ontario, where I am. We just entered the fourth wave. But many of us, right now, like, I think it's trending on Twitter or something like that. They have the urge to splurge. And like you said, they deserve a vacation. And so, what do you say to those people who are sort of saying, like, listen, I've been cooped up inside for a long time. I got to get out.
Go for it. If you feel you got to get out and take a vacation, go for it. Enjoy the bills that come afterwards. Because if I say, I want to take a vacation and get out of here, I'm financially independent.
Right.
If you say it, you're taking steps back to enjoy something, and you better really enjoy it. It's not that I haven't enjoyed my life. It's also like, it wasn't like living like, ooh, I don't want to spend any money for anything. No, like, I spend money for stuff all the time. But when I think the you deserve concept leads a lot of people to stepping outside of their means. Oh, well, you're at this level in your career, so you have to get a new wardrobe. You have to do that. And, you know, it's like, Yeah, I'm like, if you're not paying my bills, then don't tell me what I should buy. You want to pay for it? Then yeah, great. But everybody, I find it so interesting as how often I hear the phrase "you deserve" from people. Oh, you deserve to treat yourself to X. Look at how far you've come. You deserve. But nobody who ever has said you deserve to do X has ever given me a dollar to pay for that X. They're trying to spend my money.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, why are you telling me how to spend my money? Like, here, you got a credit card, right? Right. Swipe it. I'm going to go stay in that awesome Airbnb you told me I deserve.
Visa doesn't mind. They'll come after you for it.
Hey, they're going to go after them. You pay for my what I deserve. But when I got to pay for it, don't spend my money based on what you think I deserve.
It's really interesting because, that's the peer pressure and outside influence. And I wonder how much that influences our own money decisions. Mm. You know, that sort of loops or whatever. When people tell, like, the splurge that I have is coffee. Like, I like to go for coffee, but I like to go for coffee. I like to sip it. It's something I do with my wife. My kids know that we like to go to coffee shops a lot. But then, you know, my friends or my parents will say, you know, you spend a lot of money on coffee. And then I sort of, all of a sudden, I associate myself as a coffee guy. I call myself a coffee snob that knows nothing about coffee. I just wonder, do I go and spend more money on coffee because now it's part of my persona? It's supposed to be who I am. So, you know, if you're a car guy, it's like, well, of course I'm going to buy a Tesla because I'm a car guy.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm a car guy to a certain point, right? It's interesting when you can get anything you want, but you just feel uncomfortable getting it. Like, I'm like, and like, so do I know cars so well that I would know the difference if you sat me in, you know, a Ferrari 599 GTO versus the 599 Super Lega? Like, I'm like, no, I wouldn't know the difference. Well, it's like, then I probably shouldn't buy the car. Right? Because then it just becomes a way to be like, oh, well, this one's more exclusive than that one. But it's like, well, what is it about the car that makes you wanted the exclusive one versus this one? I like the color. Like, whoa, wait a second. Like, so you spent an extra X number of thousands of dollars to just have something that you could say, really what you want to say to people is, oh, there's only 20 of these made in the world. Right. But if you don't, you know, like, actually, there's a lot of people are into things that have high price tags. So therefore they can justify saying like, oh, I'm a car guy. That's why I have this. But you actually start asking them questions about cars and it's like, you couldn't change your brakes if you had to. Like, tell me the difference between normal brakes and ceramic brakes, since you're like so into them. Well, the car stops on a dime. Well, like, that's not the difference.
Like, that's the literally the marketing slogan.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? So, man, I have weird things. But like, wine is one of those things, right? So what's so interesting is I love wine. And, you know, price sometimes can reduce risk. So like when I take a vacation, I'll stay in a really nice place because I'm like, if I'm paying that much, those people probably got to be good, right? And that has worked out really well to help me enjoy some of my vacations, right? So and because I'm thinking like, okay, I don't take that many big trips like that. If I'm going to take one, I don't want to risk it, right? So sometimes there's pricing and stuff like that that's playing there. But wine for me is interesting because I read a study ages ago where they put people through an MRI and they looked at their brain when they were telling them that it was a $5 wine versus when they told him it was a $35 bottle of wine and it was the same wine. And the brain was literally sending you signals telling you that one wine was better than the other just based on you saying the pricing was there. And that price to me is so telling about our brains and money.
So I'm halfway through the book that you recommended, Decoded, and The Why of the Buy. And it's incredible. And there's so many things in there about like the peripheral vision and what we can actually see and you know, the way we buy things is like through association or known recognition or the last one where I'm at right now, they're talking about which water bottle is bigger and the one you spend it on. And it's just based on the perception that one is taller, even though it might have less volume in it. That wine story is a great one. So moving along, this is just such a human emotion. You turned down the big payday. And you said no twice. To walking twice. Oh, jeez. Was the second time easier? I just tell me about the process. That's the question here. Like, what was that? Like, you tell your wife, you employees, you know, the actual, like, the investors, you turn it down. I'm assuming jaws dropped everywhere, but
I don't know. I didn't do it for other people, so I have no investors.
Now, so good for you, right?
I turned it down because I like my job. And I like the challenges of my job. I like the people I get to work with, the clients I get to do the work for, and the communities that we serve. And as I see it, this most recent time, what I realize is, for what? This is the thing. Like, when you're financially independent, you really get to look at a huge payday and go, what am I going to do with that? Like, how's my life going to be different? Somebody's going to drop, you know, 8 figures in my bank account after tax. And how is that going to actually change what I do the next day? Well, I'm not going to go out and buy that 599 because I just feel it's too much of an indulgence. Like it's just too much. Like, so, okay, so I'm not doing that. I looked at flying private, right? Because I'm an aviation person. I love that.
Oh, yeah.
I look at flying private and you're like, well, my wife's like, no, we're not doing that. Right. And fly private, you can go through money quick flying private. You can go through money quick flying private. And and my wife's like, we're not going to raise our kids to not understand what TSA is. So then someday when they're on a class trip, you know, they go to get in line. They're like, wait, you don't have a driver that just drops you off at the plane and they take your bags and you just walk up? Like, I don't want to raise those kids. Right. So,
yeah.
So then I ultimately was like, I'm not going to do anything different. And then once you realize you're not going to do anything different, you're like, if I still love what I'm doing, then why am I going to sell this thing? And then I think that Sphere has such an opportunity to show the world different ways of doing things, both within our industry, but as well as, like, as a business. And I think every day that we're on this planet as Sphere, we are able to say to the world, this shit is possible as a company. The minute I sell it, it's somebody else's asset. And then I thought, you know, like, and then we got to hit their numbers and their goals. And that's fine, right? Because we had gotten paid for it. But then I look at my team members and I say, okay, maybe I could just give out shitloads of profit of the business back to the team and not have them waiting for some payday either. And we can keep running this thing. Because nothing would suck more than thinking of the impact that we have an opportunity to have within our community and to sell my business for no reason, like, because I'm not going to change my life, right? I'm literally going to live the same life. And I'm at the point now where I'm so close to the numbers that my people want me to get to that if I sold the business, I've already told them that I'm going to cap that out. And then the rest of it has to go into a fund where we can do charitable stuff. So however much Sphere grows, so if, let's just say Sphere is worth $50 million today, my payday would enable me to hit this like crazy number they want me to have. But then, like, most of that money that would have come to me would go into a fund for charity, which means if Sphere goes to $100 million, it's just more going to charity. I have capped out how much I will have in assets for myself so that I don't buy into the rat race of more and more and more and more. I'm like, nope, you're going to cap me out at this number. Perfect. And then once I get to that number, like, anything that this company could ever sell for sometime in the future over that has to be given away to improve things that are happening in our community. So, like, I won't see it because I'm just afraid. I'm afraid of then you start justifying to yourself that, you know, oh, I need a $50,000 table, right? And it's like, they make $50,000 tables? It's like, yes, they do.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's fucking nuts. So I'm very afraid of self-justification. I've read a lot about it. And I think it's our ability as humans to self-justify shitty things that we do is amazing. And it's scary.
Kind of like the space race. On our last show, we talked about how, you know, Bezos could probably solve, you know, hunger in America,
Bingo.
But he'd rather spend 5 minutes in space.
Bingo. And you know, and he gets to do that, right? Like, I'm not one of these people that beats up Jeff Bezos. It's like, it's his money. In the same way, I don't want people spending mine. He's choosing to do that. What I can do is grow my business to be big enough to try to help do things that Jeff is unwilling to do for some reason.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, so you chose flexibility. Flexibility was first and foremost. And I'm sort of curious, how do your employees feel now that you've made that decision? Like, has productivity, maybe productivity is the wrong word, but like, has general office happiness or like, hey, I just want to do this because I'm happier in my work?
I don't know. Very few people have talked to me about it. So I just recently gave out like $1.6 million in bonuses. And we're starting to pay bonuses every 6 months. Because I want, now that I've said to the company, like, hey, like, you know, because I give people a bunch of shares, so I'm just diluting my share ownership so I can give more of it out to the company. And so now, that you know, I think I have 54%, company has 46%. I'm just trying to bring that further and further and further down over time. And as a result, the way I've set up my phantom equity is it's like they need me to sell to be able to get that, right, their part. And I was like, I don't want to set up a system where if I keep saying no, they're hurt because I keep saying no. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm just going to start taking our profits and giving them out to people in accordance with certain values and shares and things of that nature. And I'll tell you, like, you can give out, you know, I think, you know, we give out $1.6 million to like 130, 140 people or whatever it is. And it's like, you don't hear anything back. You know, this idea of like, oh, like people are going to like be like, man, like I wasn't even expecting this. It was a freaking pandemic. Like, you know, like I can't believe that our company is doing this. It's like, you might get 5, 7, but definitely less than 10 who will intentionally hit you up and be like, yo, like the fact that you're trying not to keep this money and you are doing real steps that I'm seeing in my paycheck literally is the fruits of you being like, I don't want this. I would rather you have it. Is it's not what you think. I think a lot of people have this perception that, oh, if I'm the manager or I'm the boss and I get to my point of enough and I just start really distributing it out to my team, that they're going to be like, man, we're so much happier. That's why you're asking that question. We're happier. We're more loyal. We're this, we're that. Like, I want to work for a guy who's like, I have enough money and I should be giving this money to people in my community and people in my company. It's like, that sounds good. But the reality is, like, you can't do it. I don't do it for their happiness. I do it for my own. Because if I do those kinds of things on the hope that people will somehow raise me up on their shoulders and tell me that I'm a great person, then I would be sad. But I'm not sad or disappointed because I do it for me. Because the kind of person that I want to be and the kind of person that my mom raised is a guy that goes, you don't want to hold on to all of this because you're not going to do anything with it. It'll become a scoreboard on like how big can the number get. And I looked at where all those things led and I'm like, that's not the person I want to be. So I don't do the things that I do for people's thank yous or for their loyalty or for their happiness. I do it because I got to look at myself in the mirror and say, I could put $1.6 million in the bank for myself that I don't need. Or I can give it out to a lot of different people who can pay off their student loans, who can buy the things they want to buy and do the things that they want to do. And also communicate to them that, like, you're a part of making this money. Like, I'm good. Like, yeah. How about you get it? Right. So I had to live with myself. And that's why I do my distributions the way that I do so aggressively, because I got to make decisions that I'm comfortable with. And I am not comfortable keeping that much to myself as the owner of the business when I know that the team can do so much more with it. Cause I'm just going to stack it, cause I'm not going to go out and buy the cars and the second homes and the this and the that. So all I'm going to do is just stack it and turn it into a scoreboard.
There's a lot to unpack of everything you just said. But it happens to lead into where I was going with this anyway. So gratitude, the monks anyway will say that it's not a one-to-one relationship. Like, you put gratitude out into the world and it doesn't come back right from that person, but you get it elsewhere. You know, gratitude has been linked to better mental health and self-awareness, and especially what you're talking about, and better relationships, sense of fulfillment. There's a book, I think it's Essentialism. Greg McKeown wrote it. And he says, if you focus on what you lack, you lose what you have. And if you focus on what you have, you gain what you lack.
Mm.
Which is, I love that. And kindness and gratitude are symbiotic. Kindness is genuinely want as at, so you define this, genuinely wanting something good for someone else. And our own kindness teaches gratitude. And I wanted to, there's this study that I was just reading about where researchers from Harvard and the University of California, they wanted to do a study on kindness and is kindness contagious around people who don't know each other. And so they set up a game where strangers were grouped into like four and they were each given 20 tokens or credits kind of thing. And they could decide in private how many credits they would keep or tokens that they would keep and how many would go into a common pot. And then at the end of the round, they would divide that pot equally among those four people. And at the end of each round, the tables of four people would shuffle around and they would mix people around. And so you never knew how generous any one person was. But what they found was that players who received more in credit gave more in future rounds. So kindness begets kindness. So exactly what you're doing should lead to more kindness in your community, especially. So, and that's where I want to sort of take this is like, so you volunteer to help homeless and runaway youth. And you talk about taking your care of your employees. Why do you do those things? And or how is it so innate in you to do those things?
I don't know. You know, someday I realized. So one, I cut out. I cut down the people I follow on Twitter almost to be exclusively sites about positivity. And I did that for a while because then the only things I was getting were good things. I unfollowed, I just watched myself get really into some crazy snarky comment that a friend would leave or something. And you're just like, oh, what'd they say about? And then you're like, whoa, wait, why am I all up in your, like, what? Like, no. So I tend to surround myself heavily with, prompts that are, it's not a one-to-one relationship. You know, there's a million pieces of content out there to get you to think the world sucks and it's bad. And it's really hard to find the content that makes you think that, no, the average person is good. Right. Like if you were to read CNN every day, you would think that every black man in America has been pulled over by the cops, knows somebody that's been murdered by the cops. It's about like how bad Donald Trump still is. I'm like, isn't this guy out of office? Like, why are we still covering it? Oh, I know why. Right. Because it makes people keep coming back. And like, I'm like, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to extract myself. Right. Like how many people died of COVID yesterday? Guaranteed. I can find that in very few clicks on or give me a story about the one baby or the one kid that's under 10 that died of COVID yesterday. Right. Tragic for that family. What they're never going to say is, oh, but 80,000 kids recovered yesterday. And it's like, well, that's the reality. So I try to extract myself from things that are built to try to make me think the world is dangerous and bad. And I think that the news is really good for that. I think a lot of social media is really good for making you think that things are worse than they are, right? The opposite of that is Instagram, where everybody's life is amazing all the time, right? And then it makes you feel that your life isn't great. And I'm like, none of that's true, right? So I've extracted myself from that significantly, which I think has been a big help. I also have a gratitude app that I write in every morning. Not every morning. I fell out of it. But like, I write in it at least once a week now. But for a while, I was writing in it daily for probably a good like 6 months. And I wake up usually at like 5:30-ish in the morning to go for my runs in the morning. And I found myself, I would wake up, roll over, open my phone, look at Twitter, look at Instagram. And I'm like, oh, I'm starting my day looking at what Trump did and how happy everybody is, how awesome their lives are, right? And it's like, that's how I'm starting my day. So that's what the seeds that I planted. when I got rid of those apps on my phone and replaced them with a gratitude app, I was starting my day thinking about what do I have to be thankful for? And just starting your day from a different starting point affects the trajectory of your entire day. And then I was going on these runs, and because I live in the city, I was seeing a lot of people struggling. 6 a.m, sleeping in their car with their kids and things like that. So then running also reinforced, running through a city reinforces this sense of like, there's a lot of people struggling right now. You know, so there's that. The other thing that I did that kept me very gratitude focused is I have hard days just like anybody else at work, like days where you're disappointed by people, days where people kind of mistake your kindness for weakness. You know, you get fired by a client, you know, and whenever I walk home, this is the beauty of walking home and not being in a car or being in public, or walking home or being in public transportation, is you're not in your own bubble. And what I would do when I would walk home after tough, I do it all the time. After tough days, especially, I look every person in the eye when I walk home and I go, do you think that these people would trade places with you to deal with the problem that you had today? It's like, do you think that almost everybody you walked by would say, yeah, that was your problem today. You got fired by a client, but you're financially independent. You have healthy kids. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I would trade places with you. That's another thing that I've done. Volunteerism is huge. So, you know, when I was volunteering in the children's hospital, I was seeing kids that were sick at a time where I was really into how bad my career was before I started SEER. And all I hung around with was other people who didn't like their careers. So as a result, we just stayed in this, like, our bosses suck bubble. And the minute I extracted myself from that group and started using that time to volunteer at the children's hospital, I was like, this isn't that bad. This person literally can't take their child home. Their child is sick and may die in the hospital. Like, and I'm here as a volunteer to play with them and get their minds off of. And I started doing that volunteer work at like 24. So like just things like that have been like, they're part of the foundation. Like when you see a parent struggling with a child in the hospital, and you're there as a volunteer to bring some joy, you're like, I don't like my boss melts away pretty quick, right? But if you don't put things in your life that check that shit, and you just hang out with other people who are just like you, then like everybody's like talking about the same thing. And they're all striving for that promotion and all that. Like nobody's parent I ever talked to worried about a promotion. They worried about their baby, right? They wanted to bring that child home. And that just snapped me out of so much negativity that I had at that time in my life that, you know, and it stuck, it just sticks with me forever. You know, I'll just give you one more.
I love that.
I just tweeted about this. I was really angry. Please. So my wife and I got into a pretty heated disagreement around something related to COVID, right? And, you know, what kind of decisions we were going to make as a family. And she and I weren't on the same page. And I was hot. I was hot. And I was so hot that I'm like, I got to go for a walk. Like, I got to get out of here, man. Like, and what I decided to do is I walked to Target, or I drove to Target, and I got in the car and I drove. And I, after my walk, I got in the car, drove to Target, spent $100 to like make lunches for homeless people. So I literally went to Target, bought like bread, trail mix, baggies, all kind of stuff, went back to my house. And was like, I am making like a bunch of lunches for homeless people that I saw on my route, and I am going to drive and drop them off to them. Like, that's how I'm going to get through this point of anger or whatever it is. And that happens at work and anywhere else. And I think my natural state is to say, how can I take this thing that's got me in a bad place and find some way to put good in the world until it's a distant memory. And that's just one of the ways that I try to deal with things that upset me or disappoint me or put me into a bad place, is I try to then say, get rid of that by putting a ton of good into the world.
Perspective is,
you know what? Everything. It's such an overstated thing, but it's so fundamental. Perspective. So in Philly, where I live, I'm in San Diego today in our office, but in Philly, I have befriended a guy, a trash guy, right? And he is a sanitation worker. And he is doing all this positivity around keeping the city clean. And he's just like, while I'm on the truck, I'm doing Instagram videos to be like, this is what it's like to actually clean up your trash, right? And he and I met a couple weeks ago. I was like, I got to meet this dude. So I meet him, we're talking. And he's like, you know, a lot of people in Philly right now are mad because their trash is out for days and days and days because we're not picking it up on time. And he said to me, part of the reason why, you know, is because my guys, people are throwing out more trash because it was the pandemic and people are cleaning their homes and other stuff. And so the bags are heavier and there's more trash than ever. And he's like, we're tearing our rotator cuffs. He's like, a rotator cuff injury is a typical injury for sanitation workers who are slinging garbage over like this all the time.
Right.
He's like, when the garbage doubles, then we're doing it twice as much. He's like, so that's why people's trash is being picked up late. But if you're in Philly on any given day, 2 days after the trash day, you can just hear people complaining left and right about how can the city not do our trash? Because nobody has the perspective. And I didn't have that perspective either. But that's why you want to spend time with people who aren't like you. Because as you start to understand the perspective, you actually start to understand how the world works. And who wants to say, I don't care that you're injured or hurt. It's like, nobody would say that, but that's the why. But we have to like look a little bit past ourselves on some complaining shit to try to find out the root causes. And sometimes you realize that there's actually a reason there.
Thank you. That's fantastic. With that, we'll move into our rapid fire questions.
All right, let's do it.
That was just really great. So, what is in your wallet?
Three things. ID, Amex, Visa.
Do you have the $600 Amex? It's like this really fancy like travel card.
So there's the $4,000 Amex, which I think is the black card. I do not have.
No, not that one. Yeah.
No, but I do have the platinum. I think it's the platinum card or whatever it is. It's got a high annual fee. But as a traveler, I'm like, it gets me into these lounges that are 1,000 times better than these other lounges. Great.
Yeah.
And when my flights get canceled, I can just call a phone number and somebody's like, we will take care of all of that for you. Right. We'll find a way. Like, my indulgence is service. I love, I will pay great money to get people who I feel care about my end state. So I know this is the lightning round. So yeah, I got one of those.
A book everyone should read.
Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me.
Oh, what's that? Actually,
it's a book that basically, I'll give you an example. So you expect your doctor to wash their hands when they come and see you, right? And it's because you want them to get rid of the germs that are on their hands. Well, in 1850, we didn't know to wash our hands as health professionals, right? And there's a guy named like Erdogan Semmelweis, and he was doing research because women were dying during childbirth like crazy in this like really well-regarded hospital. And he said, I'm going to follow the doctors and see like, what's the difference? Why is it when women have in the same town, when there's a midwife involved, it's normal mortality rates for women. But when the doctors are involved, it's like 20x the death rate, right? And what he realized is there were a bunch of students at this hospital that were doing research work on cadavers in the lowest floors, working on cadavers, and then they were coming up and doing deliveries without washing their hands. Passed the disease, women were just dying of a really like bad, like skin rotting disease kind of thing, right? So it was a really bad, bad death. So Semmelweis goes, oh my God, I have found the problem. If we just stop and wash our hands, we'll disinfect our hands. And then that will cause us to save lives. The Vienna Medical Society fought his research for 13 years because in order to say that his research was accurate, you had to admit to yourself as a doctor that you were part of killing women.
Oh, right.
And it's easier to say your data's wrong because then I get to absolve myself of that responsibility. And then what happened? More women just died until it was event. And then Semmelweis went into an insane asylum and died a month after he was admitted because he just literally went crazy being like, how is it? It's like, I'm not asking people to change that much. It's like press hands, save lives. Like, why wouldn't you do that? Right. It's like the version of mask wearing today. Right? Like, yeah. Same.
Yeah.
So I say that to say that's what I love about the book. And the book also gets into things like DNA evidence. And they'll show how the same cops will use DNA to prosecute somebody, But then if DNA is ever used on somebody that they prosecuted to be like, you got it wrong, that person's not the right person, they fight the evidence.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the same science. So that book made me look at myself and ask myself, where am I bullshitting myself? Where am I going in this out in this world doing things like that? Because we all do. And I think being in tune to where your ability to police yourself when you're bullshitting yourself and go, I'm actually telling myself the wrong story right now, is a superpower. That's why I love that book.
Mistakes were made, not by me.
Yep.
Okay. What was your first job and what did you learn from it?
I was a newspaper delivery boy.
Everybody we asked recently has done the same thing, but yeah. Anyway, what did you learn from it?
So for me, it was, I learned that I like to optimize routes. I realized that I'm an optimizer because I wanted to figure out what was the best way to get through my route. And I would try different ways, but I also wanted to do it in a way that had high quality. So I wanted to get the most tips, but I also wanted to get it done as fast as possible. And I just recently reflected on this because I also had a job working in an Amazon warehouse when I was like 19. And it's true. Jeff Bezos would drive up to the warehouse back in those days in his like Honda. You know, while everybody else kind of hated their job and we work in a warehouse and it's hot and we don't like them, I was like, how fast can I pick these books? Is it the best route to take? Like, should I leave my cart at the end of the route and then go and run and get them? Or should I like bring it with me on my route? Because then I got to turn it everywhere. And like, so I always turned it into a game. That's what I learned. My ability, even at 12 years old, was to take something or 15 years old or 19 years old working in a warehouse is to turn it into a game to make the time go by faster and make me enjoy what I'm doing. So I always found a way to gamify, even when I was selling sneakers. Like I'm sitting there with people's smelly feet all day, right? But I turned it into a game. I found a way to turn almost every job I've had into a game so I could enjoy it.
that's it's awesome because of what you do now.
Isn't it great? Figure out the way to optimize the thing. It's nuts, right?
So just for those listening that might not be familiar with like search engine optimization or SEO, I mean, this is what Will is one of the best at in the world. So optimizing on a paper route to Google, it's
it's optimization. It's optimization. Taking a process and trying to, it's experimentation, figuring out what's the best way to do it and looking for the data, the information, timer. Okay, how quickly did I do it? Oh, that was slower. That was faster, you know.
You could have been an Olympian.
No, man, not with my athletic skills.
What is a commonly held belief about your industry that you passionately disagree with?
Oh. This is kind of in the weeds, but it's keywords with no search volume don't have value.
Keywords with no search volume have value or do not have value?
People believe that keywords with no search volume don't have value.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And they're complete morons.
There's a, it's a bit of a, like an industry sidebar here, but yeah, there's a guy in Toronto, Steve, Toth, and he's just put out a bunch of stuff on zero keyword search volume. And
I was talking about that like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Because all I would do is I would take SEMrush data, you know, the tools that we use, and I would say, oh, see how this tool is saying 00000. And then I would join that search term to my client's data and be like, but my client got a conversion on it. So how can you convert on a keyword that has no searches? It's impossible. So then I would go back and look at it and I'd be like, oh, 50% of this client's conversions came on keywords that these tools are saying nobody searches for.
Yeah.
Half of your conversions all year. I got the data to prove it. So it's like anybody can disagree with me if they want.
That's awesome advice. Thank you. Yep. If you had one tweet, and this is a little bit weird, but if you had one tweet that everyone in the world was guaranteed to read, like this tweet was going to go viral, what would it say?
It's the last tweet I posted. Ha. which we already talked about, which is one way to manage your anger is to put good into the world.
Right. I love that. So I have to ask this question just because it's part of the standard rapid fire questions. What's your number?
Oh my God, I can't say it.
Okay, fine.
I'll tell you, I can't say it because I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's embarrassing. It's funny. The guy I told you about earlier, who makes $750,000 a year, I was chatting with him about something related to salary stuff, and he was embarrassed to tell me. And it made me want to work with them even more, because it was one of those things that I'm like, that's how it should be, bro. It's like I had to pull it out of this guy, right? Because he was embarrassed. And then he went on to tell me, he's like, but I drive a Corolla. He's like, I'm not that guy, right? He's like, I'm not that guy, you know? And I think that there's something to be said for being less flashy, right? Like, you know, I'm wearing a Adidas t-shirt and some jeans and some sandals today, right? And I just never want to really carry myself in a way where people are like, oh, that guy probably has money. You know, I would much rather just kind of be like, no. So yeah, I'm definitely not putting that out there. But here's what you need to know. It's enough. And that's what I wish for everybody who hears this, is whatever I have as my number, it's enough for me and my family to live a good life. Probably a slightly extravagant life, but we don't indulge in that. So as a result, like my enough number is pretty freaking low, because I just don't see a world where I need more than I have. That's the true number we should all be.
That's what we should all be striving for. Yes, 100%.
Right. Is like, you know, what percentage are you to your enough number is the question. And for me, I'm probably, looking at how I spend and how cheap I can be about things, I'm probably 2x over what I actually need. And that's why I know that I don't need anything else.
Love that. And so we asked this question and it's sort of the same, but if you had no obligations and no shortage of money, what would you spend your time doing?
What I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
I'm here with my team members, who I haven't seen in almost 2 years. You know, just to say like, hey, you know, like I care about you guys. Like, even though I'm on the other side of the country, like I care about you guys, and you matter to me, and you're a person to me. You're not a number on a spreadsheet. You're a person, and that's what I want to do. Is I want to spend time with my team, help them to create runaway success for our clients. And I want to make it easy for them to try to be successful for our clients, and then turn our profit back to them and put it into our communities and help people, you know, make Sierra Beacon of a company who really tries to say we have a responsibility to the things that happen outside of our doors. And I think Sierra is a great vehicle for me to put that into the world.
Yeah. It's an interesting name for the company too, because it's, I'm assuming it's not like Sierra, a stake, but like seer into the future.
Yep.
And my last question for you, what do you want to be known for when you die?
Whatever people want it to say.
Yeah. Why do you say that? You say on your Twitter thing, it's like, I am whatever people say I am. What's the story behind
that? I steal that, from Eminem, and it's like, I am whatever you say I am. And the reason why is people for a long time have put a lot of platitudes on me. I'm successful. I'm like, you don't know if I'm successful or not, right? Like, I might have money. Money isn't success for me. We have different definitions. So I would fight against people telling me that I was successful. I would fight against people saying I was a guru. I would fight against people saying that I was, you know, one of the most knowledgeable people in the in our space. And I just found myself constantly fighting against these labels people put on me, because I believe that I'm a work in progress. I believe what makes me good in our industry is the fact that I'm not content with where I'm at, and that I'm constantly exploring and trying to find new things. So the minute I think I'm at the level, I'm not improving. And at least that's how my brain works. So that's where that I am whatever you say I am comes from, because I got tired of fighting against the labels people were putting on me, because I was just trying to keep my head down and stay as humble as possible. And people were adding these platitudes on me. Oh, you're successful. Oh, you're an expert. Oh, you're this. And I'm like, I'm not an expert. I'm like, I'm constantly trying. And oh, you're successful. I'm like, I'm not successful. Like, successful is not the money. Success is the fact that I was home to see my kids in time for the last, like, you know, 8 days. And I don't let this business just completely ruin my family life. Like, that's success. Like, and I found myself just so often trying to tell people that, like, we got different definitions of things, that I said, you know what, let me just give up on that and just tell people, you know, what do I want to be known for? Whatever people want to say about me. There are people in this world that think I'm an asshole. That's completely fine by me. And there's people in here who think that I'm a saint. And that's also completely fine by me. But I have to be somebody that I'm comfortable with.
That you're, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I have to be okay with the decisions that I make every day. And then however people interpret those decisions, that's their ability to interpret it. And they can take the same thing and think it's great. They can take the same thing and think, you know, it's not great. But I have to put my head on the pillow every day and feel good about what I put in the world.
Well, I think you've put a lot of good in the world with this recording.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for joining us, Will. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate you. Thanks for having me on. It's a different topic, so I appreciate having a different, like, spin on the topic around, like, around finances and money and philosophy. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Beat Chemist for providing us with our music. Find him on SoundCloud. I want to sincerely thank you for taking the time out of your own day and investing it in yourself to get smarter about money. Head over to ratehub.ca to learn more about making smarter financial decisions. If you want to thank us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast and follow us on Spotify. Thank you for listening. Let's help Canadians choose better with their finances.
The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views and opinions expressed by RateHub employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the views of RateHub Inc. or any of its sponsors or officials. This is for general use. We're not certified or licensed advisors.
Yeah, we just don't want to get sued.